Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Fenway Park celebrated its 100th birthday yesterday, and that had faithful stadium goers praising its charms.
It's like when you're going on Antique Roadshow and they say, oh, well, if you had cleaned this up, it wouldn't have the patina and the signs of age.
Ahead, it's a special edition of Only a Game: sports venues to renovate or demolish and replace or to simply remember fondly. We'll have reports from Miami, home of the gleaming new Marlins ballpark, from Houston, where the empty Astrodome crumbles, and from London, site of green Olympic stadia, including one designed to be removed and transported. And we'll explore the complex issues surrounding modern stadium design and renovation with several experts in the field. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is a special stadium edition of Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Miami has a brand new state-of-the-art retractable roof stadium that's approximately 100 years younger than Boston's Fenway Park, which yesterday celebrated its centennial. It's designed to save baseball in the Magic City. Phil Latzman from WLRN in Miami sends this audio postcard from the new Marlins Park.
The stadium sits on hallowed ground on the site of the legendary Orange Bowl in the section of Miami known as Little Havana. Local boy Nathan Muller says it's the perfect homage.
The place is beautiful. The ballpark is what Miami needed. The Marlins needed something. It's been a dump in sunlight forever going to games. It was easy to get to the games, but there was no buzz. There was no excitement. Although I miss my beloved Orange Bowl, we had season tickets to the Hurricane games forever. And, I mean, it's nice that if you're going to tear it down, you brought this place.
More importantly, says Marlins fan Jordan Spires, the girls like it too.
This was built for a female. It's beautiful. The whole park is beautiful. Yeah, it's cool here. Yeah. You have a sushi bar behind you.
Speaking of sushi, the ballpark is lushly appointed with a pair of 450-gallon aquariums behind home plate and a pastel-colored home run feature adorned with flamingos and, yes, marlin, which jump out each time the home team hits one out. Marlins Park, still awaiting a sponsor name, seats just 37,442, making it the third smallest capacity-wise in the majors. As for how the ballpark plays during a game, it has spacious dimensions, going nearly 420 feet to center field. But Marlins first baseman and Miami native Gabby Sanchez says it all depends on whether the roof and the windows are open or closed to determine whether pitchers or hitters will like it better.
I know that when everything is closed off, it's going to be a fair park. It's not going to be a hitter's park. It's not going to be a fielder's park. If they put the roof open and keep the windows closed, it's definitely a hitter's park.
While Miami has its long-awaited new stadium, as for whether it's a baseball town is still a matter for debate. Perhaps the best player to ever come from Miami is Hall of Fame slugger Andre Dawson, who played the last two seasons of his 20-year career with the Marlins. He's now a special assistant with the team. And he says it's going to take more time for the verdict.
But I think it's, you know, ways down the road to say, you know, what the fan base, if the fan base can be comparable to that of a Chicago or Boston or St. Louis, because you got to do a lot of winning over the years in order to create that kind of atmosphere.
And that's especially the case among the fickle fans here in Florida. For Only a Game, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Graham McNamee speaking from Navin Field in Detroit, Michigan.
Navin Field, a.k.a. Briggs Stadium, a.k.a. Tiger Stadium, officially turned 100 years old yesterday, or it would have if it hadn't been torn down in 2009 and replaced with a mostly empty lot. Fenway Park, which opened the same day as Tiger Stadium, did celebrate its 100th birthday yesterday. Inappropriately, the Red Sox lost to the Yankees 6-2. Many times over the past century, Fenway narrowly escaped the wrecking ball. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story of how Fenway made it to 100.
come out of a tunnel, it opens up, and your first thought is, my God, this is awesome, it's majestic. And your second is, wow, it's tiny. And I think every time I've ever gone into the park, those same two thoughts collide.
Janice Page edited Fenway Park, a salute to the coolest, cruelest, longest-running Major League Baseball stadium in America. It's one of at least a half dozen books about Fenway out this spring, but it's the only one co-written by the Boston Globe's John Powers. Powers loves Fenway, but that doesn't mean he's blind to the building's faults, like narrow seats in the grandstands and cramped quarters in the clubhouses. And then there's the smell.
Mostly it is a stale smell. Stale beer, you know. Anytime I'm walking through the corridor, my feet stick because people have spilled Coke on the ground.
Despite its faults, Powers isn't the least bit surprised that Boston decided to preserve its relic.
Only in Boston do we do this, right? We are the only people who will renovate the old State House after we have a new State House, or renovate an old City Hall when we have a new City Hall. We just don't like throwing buildings away.
Red Sox CEO Larry Lucchino has a much simpler explanation for the $250 million expenditure.
The Red Sox wouldn't be the Red Sox without Fenway Park.
Last Monday, Lucchino nearly took out a throng of reporters as he drove an injured Boston Mayor Tom Menino around the ballpark for his annual tour. Back in 1999, when then Red Sox CEO Jim Harrington announced that Fenway couldn't be made profitable, the mayor supported the idea of a new ballpark. But you won't catch him admitting that now.
I had some questions early on when they were trying to tell us that the bowl of the park was broken and... They showed some evidence of that fact, but then when the new ownership took over, they showed us a fact that those things could be corrected, and they did correct it.
Not all of Fenway's quirks can be corrected. Despite a slew of improvements that happen every year between the months of November and April, the mayor met with reporters just across the concourse from a metal staircase, painted green, but showing more than a few signs of rust. Leslie Sterling served as the team's PA announcer from 1994 through 1996.
I love that part of it, though, because it's like when you're going on Antique Roadshow and they say, oh, well, if you had cleaned this up, it wouldn't be worth as much because it wouldn't have the patina and the signs of age.
Oh, my goodness. There's a staircase that we use as front office employees, and the steps are out of line. Someone says, is this what we mean by charming?
Dr. Charles Steinberg came on board when John Henry, Tom Werner, and Larry Lucchino bought the team. Some say the new owners saved the park because it was a good PR move. Others say that after spending $700 million, more than twice the previous record sales price to buy the team, John Henry et al. Didn't have enough cash left to start over. But Dr. Charles points out that Lucchino had been involved with building Camden Yards at a cost of less than half the price tag of Fenway's renovations.
So you weren't doing it to save any money. You're doing it because Fenway was the inspiration for Camden Yards and the 20 or so ballparks that have followed. And when you have a chance to preserve the Mona Lisa, you do that.
Fenway has a long way to go before it reaches Mona Lisa's 500-plus years. But the question on everyone's mind this week is whether the park can make it to its next centennial celebration.
I guess that won't be our question to answer, but you do at least believe you have given future generations the opportunity to examine that question.
You know, I can't speak in depth about your beloved Fenway. I have never been there. I know about it.
Dennis Garrity is the president and CEO of Packer Fan Tours, which brought people from 21 different countries and 47 out of the 50 U.S. states to Lambeau Field last year. Lambeau is currently undergoing a $143 million project to add, among other things, about 6,700 seats. But that's not going to put much of a dent in a list of 90,000 people waiting for approximately 250,000 season tickets. Lambeau has another 45 years before it matches the 100-year mark Fenway celebrated yesterday. Can the sod that Lombardi trod make it that far?
Oh, my. things become old and obsolete and disposable in our culture so quickly, it's hard to say. I have a good feeling that Lambeau is going to be around, though, in another 45 years and beyond.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
In February, the NBA's Kings struck an agreement with Sacramento City officials for a new $391 million stadium that would have kept the team in California's capital for 30 years. Terms of that deal called for the city to contribute $255 million, arena operator AEG $59 million, and ownership an additional $73 million. But the brothers Maloof, who own the team, backed out of the deal late last week. Joining me to discuss the failed attempt to construct a royal court for the Kings is Dale Kassler of the Sacramento Bee. Dale, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you, Bill.
We spoke to you just last month about this deal that seemed pretty solid. What happened?
We've run out of words to describe it here. We go through debacle and fiasco and mess. The Maloofs say they did not back out of the deal. The Maloofs say there never really was a deal. There were about a dozen different deal points that they thoroughly disagreed with, and that the only thing they ever agreed to was kind of a handshake agreement on the framework of a deal, sort of the bare outlines. Mm. But the city, the NBA, and AEG felt that there was a deal.
One of the reported sticking points was a $3.25 million pre-development expenditure that both sides have said was the responsibility of the other. That would seem like relatively small potatoes in a deal that's $391 million altogether. Was that really the only impediment?
It was not the only impediment. It was an impediment. One of the things that the Maloofs were stressing was that they just didn't believe the revenue and profit projections that the NBA and AEG were putting out.
The Maloofs have said, the dead deal notwithstanding, they still are committed to keeping the team in Sacramento. Do people believe that?
The mayor, Kevin Johnson, is openly skeptical. He stopped short of calling them liars, but he says he doesn't know what to believe. He says they're very capable of changing their minds. He says that over and over again.
What are players and fans saying about the possibility that there will no longer be NBA basketball in Sacramento?
Well, it's interesting. The last couple of crowds have been reported at over 16,000, which is near sellout for that building. I know a lot of people are ticked off. A lot of sponsors are rethinking whether or not they want to renew their sponsorship for next season. Fans are wondering if they should renew their season tickets for next year. Somebody said to me, it seems like people in Sacramento love the Kings more than they dislike the Maloofs. So maybe people will still go to games next year. Who knows?
What's your best guess about what is going to happen going forward?
I honestly don't know. There is a possibility that the two sides could come back to the table and cobble together a new arena deal. Right now, there is so much ill will and so much distrust between the two sides, it's hard to see it happening.
Dale Kassler is a business reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Dale, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Fumbles can be costly when the so far unidentified father of a so far unidentified current University of Alabama player stumbled into the Waterford Crystal Trophy awarded annually to the winner of the BCS championship game. The world learned that the big glass football will cost $30,000 to replace. The trophy was on display this week in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where the defending champions had gathered for some spring football. The stumbling fumbler need not feel singularly cursed. In 2008, the crystal football was crunched to fragments in Florida when a recruit knocked it off its pedestal. Nice hands, kid. I wonder if he got that athletic scholarship. Meanwhile, back in 2004, the two glass footballs Florida State had won were stolen. So the 30,000 a pop baubles are probably glittering yet on some misbegotten miscreant's mantelpiece.
Whoops. I go whoops. You go whoops. Maybe I made a mistake.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on this special edition of Only a Game, a tour of the crumbling, once wonder of the world, Houston Astrodome. But first, Earth Day will be celebrated around the world tomorrow, but to the organizers of the 2012 Summer Olympics, it's been Earth Day for years. While competitors in sports from archery to wrestling go for the gold in August, this year's games and many of the stadiums in which they will be played are aiming for the green. Only a Games' Ron Schachter visited London to get a progress report.
To environmental expert Dan Epstein, the 2012 Summer Olympics will be more than a showcase for world-class athletic prowess. During his almost 3 years as the head of sustainability for the coming London Games, Epstein had the task of living up to the promise of the most sustainable Olympics ever. Going green has been an Olympic mantra since the 1990s. The 2010 Winter Games in Vancouver drew particular notice for their high environmental standards in building the Olympic Village. But as Epstein drives around the majestic venues on this 500-acre Olympic site in East London, he notes that just getting started here raised the degree of difficulty.
When we talk about sustainability, the most important thing, really, the biggest move that we made was to come to this site. Very, very industrialized, very contaminated. There was a couple of million tires on the site, hundreds of thousands of fridges and other white goods just deposited here. There was oil refinery.
As well as a host of chemical factories and a nearly century-old dumping site for mustard gas canisters from World War I. That level of pollution meant setting up a chain of soil processing plants to decontaminate the surroundings. Standing outside a few minutes later, Epstein points to the looming 80,000-seat stadium that represents another environmental first in Olympic preparation. It can easily be taken apart after the games.
It's designed in a very unique way to be the first stadium that can be demountable. So 55,000 seats plus the whole roof structure are literally designed to be taken down after the games and to be reused elsewhere or to be recycled. So we've designed a stadium that will leave a 25,000-seater athletics track, which is what we need. We don't have one of those in the city as a legacy, but we don't want any white elephants.
Before the 2016 Summer Olympics were awarded to Rio de Janeiro, London's Olympic Committee had serious discussions with Olympic organizers in Chicago, which was also bidding for the 2016 Games, about transporting the massive stadium to the Windy City. While Rio doesn't seem interested in taking delivery, Brazilian officials are scoping out the 12,000-seat basketball arena, similarly created to be dismantled and moved after the games. Epstein, meanwhile, figures that if necessary, the steel beams left over from downsizing the larger stadium can be repurposed, the large metal panels smelted, and the excess concrete crushed and reused.
So then as you come round, you see the aquatic centre, which will have two 50-metre pools, the first two international Olympic quality pools in the city.
The forces of sustainability are also at work in the architecturally stunning aquatic centre. Inside the swimming and diving facility, old water from the pool is even rerouted to the bathrooms, where it reaches fleets of low-flush toilets. For all of the green ambitions of Olympic planners, there's no shortage of critics and watchdogs, including John Gold, a professor of urban historical geography. Gold and his wife Margaret have co-edited the book Olympic Cities, which looks at sustainability successes and failures at recent Olympiads. Gold points to the housing in the Olympic Village, which will eventually be occupied by Londoners after the Games. He contends that it does not do enough in areas such as water recycling and energy conservation to reach level 6. That's the highest rung of the United Kingdom's building code for sustainable homes.
The standards that have been adopted for the village were less than should have been, and the standards that are likely to be delivered at the end are probably less than they should be. If it was being built to full sustainability, it would be built to level 6, and it's not, it's being built to level 4. So it's 44% sustainability against 100%.
London Assemblyman Darren Johnson belongs to the Green Party and serves as deputy chair on the city's Environment Committee.
It looks as well that the renewable energy targets that the Olympics organisers set themselves of generating 20% of the energy used during the Games by renewable resources, they say they are really struggling to meet that target.
That number will likely drop to 11%, in part because plans for massive wind turbines were scrapped. The longer-range goal of inspiring greater sustainability throughout England is similarly in doubt. A recent poll sponsored by General Electric found that just 12% of the public believe that the green example of the coming Olympics will rub off.
This station is Canada Water. Change here for London Overground.
This rider on London's venerable underground says that the full-throttled attempt at sustainability is an Olympic event that he welcomes.
You know, our carbon footprint in the environment is on everyone's mind now, so whether it's about your own personal life or whether it's about the Olympics, I think everyone is hoping we can do a bit more for the environment and maybe do things a bit smarter than we did 20, 30 years ago.
But proponents and critics can at least agree that when it comes to going green, the 2012 Summer Games and their aftermath are bound to set some Olympic records. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
If all goes according to plan with the Olympic Stadium in London, the city will avoid comparison with perhaps the most hideous stadium failure in modern Olympics history, the centerpiece of the 1976 Games in Montreal. When that stadium was in the planning stages, then International Olympic President Rousseau's projections were rosy.
The 1976 Olympic Games would be self-financing, without adding in any way to the Canadian taxpayers' burden, without any special subsidy of any type whatsoever.
It didn't work out that way. Olympic Stadium's cost overruns were spectacularly excessive. Over the years, the building required numerous expensive repairs. The people of Montreal didn't finish paying the bill, which climbed to over $1 billion until 2006, by which time the building had been without a regular tenant for 2 years. It still doesn't have one. According to Sarah McIntyre of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, the only solace for citizens of Montreal was that Olympic Stadium earned a darkly amusing nickname.
It's affectionately called the Big O, and that's not just the letter, it's the O-W-E for taxpayers. It was originally built to have a retractable dome roof. Again, the design was flawed, the materials were flawed, so it's really turned into a big headache and a big drain for taxpayers.
The shape of things to come in our national sport as the baseball season gets underway. The spanking new Astrodome is the new $31 million home of the Houston Astros, a dome stadium that holds nearly 50,000 for a baseball game and more for conventions and meetings.
In 1965, the Houston Astrodome was billed as the eighth wonder of the world. But outfielders who couldn't find fly balls against the retractable dome's lucite panels didn't find it so wonderful. That led to the painting of some of the panels, and that led to the death of the grass on the field, and that led to AstroTurf. The Houston Astros played in the Dome for 35 years. The building was also home to the NFL's Oilers until 1999, but except for emergency duty housing victims of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the building has been empty for more than a decade. Recently, the press was admitted to the Astrodome, and what they found was not pretty. David Barron of the Houston Chronicle joins me from KUHF in Houston. He was one of the reporters on the tour. David, describe for us what you saw on the field itself, in the locker rooms and elsewhere in the building.
Well, a lot of disarray, actually. There was a fire at the Dome at one point last year, an electrical problem, and there was a pit on the Astrodome's floor where some of the AstroTurf was stored. During baseball season, for example, the football turf would be stored in that area, and then vice versa. When the power shorted out, the pit could not be opened, and so basically water from a water leak that had occurred in the building basically they collected in this 8-foot deep pit and was there for several weeks and several months because of the lack of electrical power. They could not siphon all the water out. So basically the old football AstroTurf sort of marinated in this pit for probably the better part of a year. And if right before we were admitted, they'd been able to open the pit, they'd removed the AstroTurf, and it was sort of strewn across the concrete floor of the dome drying out. So it was a bit of a shock to see that.
Maybe it's the romantic in me, but I like to think that a building that's been essentially empty for that long, you'd go in and it would be haunted and there would be, you know, the noises of old home runs clattering around in empty seats.
One of my favorite stories of the Dome was in 1980, the first time I covered a football game there. I went up in the press box, got off the press box elevator. The sports information director for the University of Houston was in front of me, and I saw him stumble. And I saw his shoe fly off to the side, and I talked to him later. I said, well, Frank, are you okay? Did you stumble getting off the elevator? He said, no, I almost stepped on a rat. So what I thought was his shoe was actually sort of a rat that was sufficiently large enough that it looked as big as a foot. And so the Astrodome rats were legendary, and so were the cats that they kept inside the building to deal with the rats. Currently, though, I think the rats are gone and the cats are gone because there's no longer a source of food inside.
And they had to bring in, of course, the dogs to take care of the cats. And so it's, now you've got like feral dogs in there, I'm sure.
This sounds like the old kids' book of Fly went by. But right. No, there were no dogs in the dome, to my knowledge.
Was the Astrodome originally built just because Judge Roy Hofhinds, the owner of the Astros, thought indoor baseball would be a draw?
I think indoor baseball would have been a necessity in Houston, frankly. The mosquitoes were legendary at Old Colt Stadium. And actually, I've still had complaints from announcers who come into town during the early part of the year when the Minute Maid Park roof is opened, who swear that the mosquitoes somehow fly over the open roof of Minute Maid Park and somehow find their way to the broadcast booth. So our mosquitoes are somewhat legendary. So I believe at that point during the 1960s that indoor baseball was really a necessity for baseball in Houston.
Is the general feeling in Houston now that the Astrodome was a great thing 47 years ago, or do people look back and say, nah, it was a mistake from the beginning?
I think people still generally have a very great sense of appreciation and admiration and nostalgia for the Dome, both for what it represented in terms of putting Houston to a degree on the map as a forward-looking city during that time frame, and just in terms of the things that they saw there when they were young, impressionable fans of either baseball, football, the rodeo, the circus, basically everything that came into the building. I think that people still have a good deal of nostalgia and appreciation for the building and what they saw there.
The Astrodome has been described as, quote, virtually idle ever since the Astros moved into Minute Maid Park in downtown Houston in 2000, but it hasn't been completely idle. What has happened in the Dome since then?
There have been a few high school football games. I think the final official event in the Dome was a bar mitzvah, and it was also used for the better part of a decade in conjunction with the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, which is held for about a month every year during the spring.
That must have been one large bar mitzvah.
It must have been something. I presume they just rented out the floor area. That they didn't have anything in the suites or anything in the stands. They just rented something out on the floor, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, what's your best guess about the future of the building?
I'm not sure if there is a best guess at this point. There's been an estimate that it would cost probably about $100 million to demolish and remove asbestos, put something on top of where the building now stands, and to pay off the $30 million that Harris County still owes on the improvements that it made in the late 1980s to keep Bud Adams from moving the Oilers to Jacksonville. And then, of course, 7 years later, he moved the Oilers to Nashville, Tennessee. So that wasn't exactly money well spent, unfortunately.
David Barron of the Houston Chronicle recently toured the Astrodome. He joined me from KUHF in Houston. You can find a link to photographs of the building at onlyagame.org. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
All the people frequenting the Astrodome in a crowd, some are still alone. Couldn't help but notice him by the gate. He was a quiet man. He never stayed out late.
You're listening to Only a Game. Stadiums, some of the best places to see games aren't big enough for that designation. You get to City Island Park in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, by taking an exit that's halfway across a bridge over the Susquehanna River. The park is AA small. I went with my brother-in-law, who remembered most of his at-bats from the season he'd played with a minor league team in the Twins organization. We drove through two late-afternoon rainstorms to get there. During the second, we almost turned around. When we arrived, there was a rainbow over the outfield. We sat behind three scouts, two of them had radar guns. While one hopeful after another stepped to the plate for the Harrisburg Senators, I asked my brother-in-law how far he'd have gone if the manager of the rookie league team for which he'd played in North Carolina 30-odd seasons earlier hadn't tried to turn him into a power hitter and wrecked his swing. I could have made it, he said, and it was a fine dream in a small and lovely place. Which is not to say great stadium-related memories can't be generated in great big places where the tickets are tough to get and the home team occupies important space in the soul of the city. Years after I saw that game in Harrisburg, I saw a game in Spain. We flew from Boston and changed planes somewhere in Switzerland, which seemed weird, and we learned on the bus from the airport to our hotel in Barcelona that if we lined up at the stadium in a couple of hours, we could get tickets to see the home team play Racing Santander. Some of the people on the bus said they'd rather sleep off the jet lag, which also seemed weird, at least to me. The game was not close, but it was beautiful. The stadium, which is almost three times the size of Fenway Park, and so perhaps 15 times the size of City Island Park, was full of people with blue and red FC Barcelona banners and scarves and caps. They cheered and sang and celebrated throughout the occasion, because it was an occasion. They were old men whose grandfathers had brought them to their first Barcelona games. They were mothers and fathers with children. They were as happy and loud as any crowd I've ever seen. When I asked questions of the three young men behind us, they shrugged off my bad Spanish and answered me politely. FC Barcelona was not then the powerhouse it has been for the past several years. It was merely the team of the people of that place, merely that. There was no championship at stake that evening. For me, there was nothing at stake at all but the invitation to participate joyfully in something everybody was so obviously enjoying. I've told the story of that day to lots of soccer fans, most of them Americans. Some of them have listened politely, and those who have understood have smiled and nodded and wished they'd been there. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
Aggieland Outfitters is not to be confused with a nickname for folks associated with Texas A&M University. The latter group is serious about this because they want everybody to know that the Aggies, unlike Aggieland Outfitters, understand that whereas North Carolina is not associated with the Southeast Conference, Missouri and Texas A&M are. This week, the aforementioned Aggieland Outfitters featured a new SEC t-shirt with a map logo that failed to include the states of Texas and Missouri, but did include North Carolina. "We apologize for the inaccuracies," a company spokesperson said. "Many members of the media, especially those connected to other schools in Texas, have insinuated that Texas A&M made those shirts and that they don't know geography." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a roundtable discussion featuring three of the architects most responsible for some of the edifices we've been celebrating during the show. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Wednesday, Pat Summitt officially stepped down from her head coaching position at the University of Tennessee. She had coached women's basketball there for 38 years. Which do you find more impressive, her 8 national titles and record 1,098 wins, or the fact that 74 of her former players' assistants or managers are now coaching college basketball?
That's really quite a family tree. I think the single most impressive thing was her bravely announcing that she has early onset Alzheimer's and coaching another season with it anyway.
I know that college basketball is all about recruiting and turnover is to be expected, but were you surprised at the extent of the turnover among the members of this year's NCAA champion men's team at Kentucky?
Well, I feel really bad for Kyle Wilcher, who is also a freshman, is the only one of a seven-man rotation who's going to be back the first day of practice next year. The entire starting five plus some subs left. And this is the way they're going to do business at the University of Kentucky from now on.
We are moving into the very end of the regular season in the NBA, Charlie, and it's hard times for Dwight Howard.
Yeah, Dwight is probably the most famous of this kind of really kind of frenzied spate of injuries towards the end of the season. This, of course, obviously puts Orlando out of any serious NBA title contention, if they were ever in any serious NBA title contention. But it also really puts a damper on the offseason free agency. He's committed to staying in Orlando, blah, blah, blah. Everybody in the league knows he wants out of there. Now he's damaged goods. That makes it a far more interesting transaction than it was before.
The Indianapolis Colts informed Andrew Luck this week that he would be the beneficiary of their number one pick in next week's NFL draft. It's not exactly news, is it?
No, not at all. And neither is the fact that Washington will pick Robert Griffin III as the second pick. One of the ways you know why these are solid rumors is that they're already starting to leak things about people having, you know, less arm strength than we thought and character issues and stuff like that.
On Tuesday, Phoenix Coyotes ruffian Rafi Torres ran the Blackhawks' Marian Hossa, resulting in Hossa's hospitalization. Torres was suspended indefinitely. Before the playoffs began, it would have been safe to say that hockey seemed to be cleaning up its act, but now I guess not so much.
Well, they'll clean up their act if they suspend Rafi Torres for a year, because he is a recidivist offender on this sort of thing. He did it with Vancouver last year. He's done it in the playoffs here. The NHL can ill afford having its prime showcase at the end of the season and probably the most compelling postseason any sport has turned into a goon show.
Charlie, this show has been dedicated to the discussion of various venues in which our games have been or will be played. Have you a favorite stadium, arena, or park story to
yes,
share with us?
Yes, it's very odd, but my favorite venue for all sports in this country is Keeneland Racetrack in Kentucky.
Hmm.
It's like walking up a road into a bell jar from a more civilized time. and while Keeneland is my favorite current venue for any sport, my favorite all-time venue for a sport is departed, and oddly enough, would be celebrating its 100th anniversary this week if it was still standing, and that's Tiger Stadium in Detroit, which I always just adored going to.
One-time home of the Dead Milkmen.
I saw the Dead Milkmen at a game there when their biggest fan, Jim Wailwander, hit a couple of home runs, and Sparky Anderson said of the Dead Milkmen, "Them boys don't go out in the daylight very much."
As you know, baseball parks garner more than their share of sentimentality, but what about a football, hockey, or basketball venue to which you have a particular emotional attachment?
Well, I mean, I have a real emotional attachment to the old Milwaukee Arena, which is where I used to go watch Al McGuire and Marquette play when I was in college. Since then, the one I really fell in love with was Allen Fieldhouse at Kansas University, because before you go to the game, you can go to the cemetery and put a flower on James Naismith's grave.
All right. Finally, Charlie, you have before you a list of the allegedly 20 funniest stadium names of all time. Would you care to pick a favorite or three among them?
Well, I went through with some serious, you know, kind of criteria here. Like, for example, I don't think Middlefart Stadium is the best because it's actually located in a town called Middlefart.
Yeah.
So it really,
sure,
you can't do anything with that, okay? I really thought the Dripping Pan in England was you know, kind of icky thing, but mm-hmm. not too bad. But I think probably my favorite one is in Bern, Switzerland, where the young boys of Bern play at Wankdorf Stadium.
I have looked at this same list that
okay.
you've been looking at, and I want to know why Craven Cottage isn't on it.
Well,
that's
now,
my
where's
favorite
Craven Cottage?
That's in England. It is my favorite stadium name of all time. How can you? I mean, it sounds like where Harry Potter should have played, you know, against Voldemort. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. And, of course, he joins me each week here at Craven Cottage. I mean it, only a game. Thank you, Charlie.
Wankdorf Stadium.
And there used to be a ballpark where the field was warm and green.
Congratulations to Wanda Williamson-Mays, who has to be nicknamed Willie, Tom Cheatham, Bernie Anderson, Jerry Cordaro, and Annie Whitney for winning copies of John Grisham's new baseball novel, Calico Joe, in last week's Facebook Only a Game Like-a-Thon. This week, we're looking at sports venues past and present. If you'd like to see a photo of yours truly at the Polo Grounds when I was a very, very, very young New York baseball Giants fan, check out our new Facebook timeline at Only a Game Radio. Scroll to the bottom or click Start at the right-hand side of the page. And while you're there, tell us about your all-time favorite stadium or arena and why you love it. That's facebook.com/onlyagameradio.
Rock candy and a great big 4th of July, with the fireworks exploding all across the summer sky.
When Cal Ripken first stepped onto the field of Orioles Park at Camden Yards in 1992, he said, "It feels like baseball has been played here before." That no doubt delighted Janet Marie Smith, one of the designers of the ballpark that has been the model for the so-called retro parks that have been built over the past 20 years. She's currently the Vice President of Planning and Development for the Baltimore Orioles. Ms. Smith, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining me is Greg Sherlock, a principal at Populous, a global architectural firm. He was the lead designer of Cincinnati's Great American Ballpark and the new Miami Marlins Ballpark. Greg, welcome.
Thank you.
And Professor Philip Best, Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Notre Dame School of Architecture, where he teaches urban design and theory. He helped organize and lend credibility to the movement to save Fenway Park. Professor Best, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill. It's nice to be here.
Yesterday, the Red Sox celebrated the 100th anniversary of Fenway Park. Philip Best, tell us a little bit about the days of the late 90s when it looked as if Fenway would be a target for the wrecking ball.
Happily, a group of baseball fans and civic-minded neighborhood residents came to the rescue. They sponsored this proposal to figure out alternative ways to save, to renovate Fenway Park, in opposition to the plan that the then Red Sox owners had put together to demolish Fenway Park and build a replica adjacent to it. And they perceived rightly that that would not have been good for the Red Sox and not have been good for Boston and the neighborhood. And so we organized this design charrette, and happily some good things came out of it.
Ms. Smith, from 2002 until 2009, you worked with the current Red Sox owners to not only save but significantly renovate Fenway Park. How did you go about preserving tradition while providing modern amenities there?
Well, one of the criteria that John Henry, Tom Warner, and Larry Lucchino gave to the design team was that we were going to play ball there. We were not going to move the Red Sox away from Fenway. And in many respects, I think that criteria helped shape the end solutions, because it meant instead of going in and doing a wholesale remodel of Fenway Park, we were looking to do seasonal improvements. So we only had, 4 months each off season to do construction. And that incremental approach, I think, allowed us to get to know the fan base. It allowed us to get to know the ballpark. It allowed our architects, D'Agostino, Izzo, and Quirk, to look closely at how things could be woven into the park instead of hammered into them. And we learned a lot from the work that Phil Best and his group did. They really did bring one of the first credible plans for renovating Fenway to the table.
Mr. Sherlock, you've not only been the lead designer for three major league ballparks, you have helped develop facilities for a soccer team in Guadalajara and baseball teams in Taipei and Hiroshima. Is there a common approach evident in all those recent projects?
Somewhat. The framework, from an architect's mind in terms of designing a building, is understanding its location. You know, we really dig down in the beginning to find the essence of the place. And those sort of findings begin to manifest themselves in a lot of different ways, sometimes abstract, sometimes in rational ways, sometimes in poetic ways.
Ms. Smith, do you have the feeling that the ballparks that we're celebrating today, Fenway and others, are a direct result of having sort of botched designs sort of in previous decades?
Mm, I I might say it a little bit differently. certainly celebrating Fenway is its own thing, right? There's been no baseball park in America that's ever gotten to 100. And Oriole Park at Camden Yards, which just turned 20 this season, certainly pays homage to Fenway and the way that it fits into the city, the saving of the B&O warehouse, and even the seat color, the masonry arches and the steel trusses are borrowed from that era. But the generation of parks, which we love to hate, those multi-purpose facilities, weren't really anybody's fault. So it's kind of nice that we're back to a point of having our own parks so that they can really be a reflection of the game that's going on there.
I'll direct the next question to Philip Best. Do you have a favorite stadium?
I've been going to Wrigley Field for, 31 years, and I do not get tired of going to Wrigley Field. I would have to say Wrigley is unquestionably tops on my list. I've been back to Fenway now, I think, three times since Jana Marie and her team have been working their magic, and really enjoy it. I've enjoyed the couple of occasions I've been to Camden Yards. Coors Field is one of the better ones, PNC in Pittsburgh. Generally, I prefer the ones that are clearly site-specific and that have views of the city, views of a river, something that locates it specifically in its place.
And Mr. Sherlock, what about you?
My favorite stadium in the world is the Munich Olympic Stadium by Freato. I experienced this as a sort of a young traveling architect through Europe, and it's really a wonderful stadium. It just blends in with this park setting. The bowl is sort of set into the ground, and it's this glass sort of tent structure that organically sort of drapes over the top. Oh. And it really does elevate your senses of place. So that would be the most profound stadium, in my opinion.
We're in the age of retro ballparks now. The age of the multipurpose park has apparently passed. I hope it has. And nobody's excited about artificial turf these days. But what's the next generation of stadia likely to look like?
The stadium of the future is going to be a facility that's transformable, if you will. You know, you can imagine a retractable roof, changing seating configurations, all these kinds of things that allow a facility sort of to adapt itself. And this would have to be successful, this would have to go much further beyond what we think of from the old multipurpose stadiums.
Ms. Smith, do you go along with this idea of transformable buildings?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I might put a footnote on the word retro. When HOK set out to design Oriole Park at Camden Yards, there wasn't any notion of making it a retro park. I think the media has picked up on that term just because it's a quick soundbite. But It was really meant, as Bill Best said a moment ago, about fitting into the context and using the surroundings to tell you what to do. And I know their approach on AT&T Park and PNC in Pittsburgh were based on that kind of response. I would argue that Craig's new park in Miami is a contextual park. You know, it's responding to things about Miami and South Beach and how it sits there. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways of looking at that.
Mr. Bess, are you okay with this idea of transformable buildings as long as they reflect the context of the team?
No, actually, I may have a little bit of a different perspective on this. Well, I agree with Janet that the whole idea of retro ballparks is a kind of media soundbite. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with it, I think, is that it blurs the distinction between the urban ballparks that were built in the 90s and the urban ballparks that were built prior to 1923. They were really built between 1909 and 1923, the ones of which Wrigley and Fenway are the only survivors, you know, the group that included Ebbets Field and Forbes Field and Yankee Stadium and all that group. And one of the big differences, I think, between that group of ballparks and what's been built in the 90s is that the ones in the 90s are urban, but it's kind of a consumer item under the generic heading of entertainment, whereas the ballparks that were built in the early part of the 20th century were parts of cities that were conceived of as neighborhoods. Springsteen played Fenway a couple years ago. Springsteen's going to play Wrigley this year. Both Fenway and Wrigley, designed first as baseball parks in neighborhoods, nevertheless lend themselves to other kinds of uses. What I think that suggests, a way to go to think about these ballparks, is to, again, think about the ballpark first for baseball and realize that in thinking about it first as baseball, it's going to create a certain character to the park that's going to make it lovable, that in turn makes it a popular venue for other kinds of activities. And I don't see a whole lot of that that's happened even in the last 20 years.
Philip S. is the author of City Baseball Magic, Plain Talk and Uncommon Sense about Cities and Baseball, among other books. He's also the Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Notre Dame School of Architecture. Professor Best, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Greg Sherlock's most recent Major League Baseball project is Marlins Ballpark in Miami. He's a principal at Populous, a global sports facility design firm, and he joined me from KCUR in Kansas City. Mr. Sherlock, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation.
And Janet Marie Smith is the Baltimore Orioles Vice President of Planning and Development, but you can find her fingerprints on venues in Atlanta and Boston, as well as at Camden Yards. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. We had help this week from John Steele at KUHF in Houston and from Alex Smith at KCUR in Kansas City. Special thanks to Amanda Art and to Tovia Smith. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's Fenway Park pictures or view the Houston Chronicle's Astrodome photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word this week comes from the machinery used to take down Tiger Stadium on July 15, 2008. There used to be a ballpark right there. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.